Zombies, vampires, and ghosts. I like it when a sermon starts out that way, right? I don't know if you've noticed, but especially in the last 20 years, Americans have gained an obsession with death and the supernatural. You see it on TV, you see it in movies, you see it in books. Now, as Christians, we kind of look at this and we say, oh, that's not good. That's not healthy. You know, that's all the devil's stuff. Or we maybe secretly watch the shows, you know, and maybe not so secretly watch The Walking Dead. Personally, I couldn't get into it, but I know a lot of Christians that love that show. But the reality is, what we've done in the church is, other than talking about the resurrection one Sunday during the year, we don't talk about death unless there's a funeral. And even then, often, we kind of, you know, oh, it's okay, it's all right, you know, it's part of life. And that's just kind of the end of it. Is this been your experience? Now other cultures have maybe a healthier, or maybe they're just more open about it. But we have this day during the year called Halloween. You know Halloween? Halloween used to be a Christian day. In fact, it was the first of 3 days. There was Halloween, and then there was All Saints Day. And for the sake of my sick brain, I can't remember what the third day is. But it was a 3-day event of remembering those that had already passed away, those that had gone on before. Now, in other cultures, in Hispanic cultures, there's the Day of the Dead, right? And it's kind of similar to Halloween a little bit, but it's the same idea. It's this celebration of the dead, or this recognition of the dead. Now, like I said, we've kind of gained this obsession with it. But the reason there's been this obsession is because there has been a vacuum. And anytime there's a vacuum of what's healthy and good, we try and fill it with something. And we try and put something in its place. Well, as we come today, we come to John chapter 11. We're going to be looking at the story of Lazarus. Who's familiar with this story? Anybody familiar with this story? Okay. Some dead guy, you know, and then he's not, right? All right, so let's look at this passage here. Luke 11. Now, a man named Lazarus was sick. He was from Bethany, the village of Mary and her sister Martha. Now, Bethany, I don't know if, you know, how up you guys are on your biblical geography. You know, I don't know. That's a joke. But Bethany was this town that was just outside of Jerusalem. Now Jesus, we know from the previous chapter that Jesus was actually on the other side of the Jordan in another town also called Bethany, where John had been baptizing and where Jesus was actually baptized. He was kind of hanging out over there because it wasn't safe for him any longer to be in Jerusalem, and it really wasn't safe for him to be up in Galilee either. So he's actually kind of left Israel, and he's hanging out on the other side of the Jordan. But there's this man named Lazarus, who's from Bethany on, I guess, on our side of the Jordan, or on the side of the Jordan near Jerusalem. And this is like a 100-mile trip between the two Bethanies. So it's a bit of a distance. So he finds out that Lazarus is sick. Now, Bethany is the village of Mary and her sister Martha. Now, this is the first time in John that we hear about Mary and Martha, okay? But we know of Mary and Martha because of, if we've read our other Gospels, they show up in other places. So Jesus knew these people. They weren't just, oh, they're just these people in this story. But they were people that he knew and he knew well. And they were friends of him. In fact, every time he was in Jerusalem, he usually stayed at the home of Mary and Martha. Now, their brother was Lazarus, and he was sick. And after laying sick this last week, let me tell you, I was a little concerned knowing that I was preaching on Lazarus. I didn't want to become an object lesson, okay? Now Mary, whose brother was Lazarus, lay sick, was the same one who poured perfume on the Lord and wiped her feet wiped his feet with her hair. So the sisters sent word to Jesus, "Lord, the one you love is sick." Like I said, we know these two sisters because they show up in Luke. And we see that Jesus, as he's visiting Jerusalem, he comes to a village and a woman named Martha opens up her home. Now, if you read about these women, you notice a couple of things. First of all, it's talking about women, which is unusual in this time period. Now, Jewish people had a pretty good and healthy opinion of women, but they still didn't necessarily see them as equals. So for them to be even in the story is kind of a big deal. So she had this sister Mary. Now Mary's the one that in the other passage they tell us that she put perfume on Jesus and wiped his feet with her hair. But she's also famous because she's the one who sat at Jesus' feet. Now, this is really unusual because in those times, only male students sat at the feet of a teacher. Now, that Jesus was willing to have a woman sit at his feet is a pretty big deal, okay? He's allowing her the opportunity to not only learn from him, but to be seen as an equal with the other disciples that are sitting there at his feet. In fact, he even says to Martha as she's worrying about the fact that Mary's not in the kitchen, "Martha, Martha," the Lord answered, "you are worried and upset about many things, but few things are needed, or indeed only one. Mary has chosen what is better, and it will not be taken away from her." Now, this is important because as we're looking back at these two women, if we've heard of them before, we've gotten the impression that Mary is this dedicated woman who's worshiping the Lord and wants to sit at his feet and wants to know him. And Martha's kind of this worrywart who's in the kitchen, okay? But there's another side of Martha that we're going to see. Now, they've sent word to Jesus, and like I said, it was 100 miles away. So this was maybe like a four-day journey at best, if you're hoofing it. Because most people can walk about 20 miles in a day. So we're talking about a 4 or 5 day journey to get to Jesus and let him know what's going on with Lazarus. And as Jesus hearing this, his response is, "This isn't going to end in death." Now, that's good news, right? If somebody's sick, and considering how the flu's been going around and having had it this week, having the flu is no small thing, right? I mean, a lot of people have died this year because of this disease, right? So hearing that it's not going to end in death is kind of a big deal. Jesus says, "No, it's for God's glory that God's Son may be glorified through it." Now, Jesus loved Martha and her sister and Lazarus. So when he heard that Lazarus was sick, he stayed where he was 2 more days. And then he said to his disciples, "Let's go back to Judea." Now, this has always kind of puzzled me a little bit. Wait a second. He's sick, so you're going to stay 2 more days. I mean, you know, that's kind of unusual, don't you think? Let me tell you a story. Back in 2012, my grandmother, who I deeply love, and I had actually lived with my grandparents for a time, had gotten very sick, and she was in her mid 70s, so she wasn't a spring chicken anymore. And I got a call from my aunt one day, and she said, "You need to come see your grandmother. She's sick. And we're not sure how much longer she's going to be around." Now, let me tell you, I didn't say, "This is going to be okay. You know, I'll wait a couple days." Now, I packed up my car, And I drove the 430 miles to my grandmother's house, only to find out that in transit, she had been moved to the hospital in Nashville, which was about hour and a half away from where they are living up in North Tennessee. And I went to see her because I loved my grandmother. I wanted to know that she was going to be okay. And I wanted to pray for her because I wasn't ready to lose her, you know? So for Jesus to say this, I don't know about you, but it seems a little callous, don't you think? And yet he knows that it's for God's glory, that God may be glorified through it. Now, remember, I reminded you that Jesus is not welcome in Israel anymore, or in Judea, or in Galilee. He's not welcome among the Jews. He's kind of preached himself into a corner where the Jewish leaders are pretty upset with him. And they don't want him around. They don't want him preaching any longer. In fact, they've tried to stone him several times. And it's just not safe for him. So when he says, "Let's go back to Judea," he finally, after 2 days, says, "Let's go back to Judea." The response is from "Did you forget, Jesus? But a little while ago, the Jews tried to stone you, and you're going to go back there?" I mean, you got to think, these disciples were a little afraid themselves. They liked what Jesus had to say. They believed that he was the Messiah, but they weren't ready to give their life for him just yet. And they weren't ready to do that. But Jesus responds. It's interesting. He keeps coming back to the light. "Are there not 12 hours of daylight? Anyone who walks in the daytime will not stumble, for they see by this world's light. It is when a person walks at night that they stumble, for they have no light." After he said this, he went on to tell them, "Our friend Lazarus has fallen asleep, but I am going there to wake him up." Now, I think Jesus is trying to remind them, I'm the light. If you're walking with me, you don't have to worry about the darkness. Now, I don't think he's necessarily telling them they're perfectly safe. But at the same time, they need to remember that they are in the light. They are walking with him, and they need to feel that being with him is worthwhile. So he tells them that he's fallen asleep, and he's going to go wake them up. And they're like, well, if he sleeps, he's going to be okay. You know, if somebody has a fever and they sleep, it means the fever is going to break, right? They're going to be okay. They're going to get better. Well, that's not what he's telling them. He's telling them, no, he's dead. Now, I'm sure they were as shocked as we are that Jesus then had waited 2 days. Because they know what he's done. They've seen him heal people. They've seen him do the miraculous. They've seen him do the supernatural. And Thomas's response was, well, let's go die with him. You know, doubting Thomas has this moment of courage and says, well, let's go die with Jesus. And maybe it wasn't quite the brave thing he was saying. Maybe it was just kind of a defeatist. Well, if he's going to go die, then there's really no point in us not going with him. Jesus says, Lazarus is dead, and for your sake, I'm glad I was not there, so that you might believe. But let us go to him. So then Jesus goes. Now remember, it took him 4 days. So when he said he's dead, this was probably a word of knowledge. This was something the Spirit told him. Nobody came and told Jesus that Lazarus was dead. But in the process of him going, it took him 4 days, right? So he arrives on the fourth day. And like I said, Bethany was real close to Jerusalem, only 2 miles away. And many of the Jews, and this word Jews means religious leaders, had come because Lazarus apparently was somebody important. Okay? They knew this guy. And they came to be and grieve. Now, Jews have this wonderful thing called Shiva. Have you heard of this? It's this thing they do where they don't just grieve. We talk about grieving. And grieving's a feeling. It's not an action. Grieving's something we feel when we have loss. Okay? But the beauty of Shiva is it's mourning. Mourning is the action you need to take when you're grieving. Because without that action, nothing happens with that grief that's good. That grieving turns into other things. It turns into anger. It turns into bitterness. It turns into resentment. It turns into all these things that are frankly really not healthy for us. So it's good to have a practice like they practice here with Shiva. Now Shiva starts out with grieving or being in a process of mourning for 7 days where they sit and they wait and people come and they sit with you and they wait with you and they process with you your loss. And they do that for a whole week. And then for another 3 weeks, you don't eat anything that tastes good. You just eat to survive. And you continue to mourn and show outwardly your loss. One of the other things about this week is a lot of it is intentional wailing. Like forcing yourself to actually cry and get the emotions out. Now in America, when we lose somebody, we kind of go in our room and we keep our tears to ourselves for the most part, unless we can't. But maybe we need to be more like them. Maybe when we lose someone or something or have disappointment, we need to turn our grieving into mourning so that our mourning can turn into dancing and we can be joyful people again. So Jesus comes to them and there are these people there comforting them. When Martha heard that Jesus was coming, she went out to meet him, but Mary stayed at home. Lord, Martha said, if you had been here, my brother would not have died. But I know that even now God will give you whatever you ask. Wow. This is a statement of faith. See, she knew Jesus could have healed him, which is why they sent word in the first place. It wasn't an announcement, hey, by the way, our friend is sick. No, it was a request. Come and heal our brother. And yet Jesus waited. And Martha's response is, why didn't you come? You could have healed him. But this is where the faith comes in. She says, but even now, I know that if you ask, the Father will give it to you. He'll give you whatever you ask. And Jesus' response is, your brother will rise again. And Martha's like, yeah, I know. He'll rise on the last day. He'll rise, you know, on Judgment Day. You know, that was the Jewish belief. And that's our belief as Christians too, right? When Jesus comes back, those who are in Christ will rise. Well, the Jews had the same belief we do. Someday, the resurrection's going to happen. That's an easy thing to believe in, because it's out there somewhere. But what's more difficult is what comes next. But Jesus said to her, I am the resurrection and the life. The one who believes in me will live even though they die. And whoever lives by believing in me will never die. Do you believe this? He challenges her theology with a question. Do you really believe that I am the resurrection and the life? Not that the resurrection is going to happen someday. But do you believe that I have the power within me now to be the resurrection, that through me, life happens, that through me, I'm putting death to death, I'm putting it to an end. Do you believe that? And she says, I believe. I believe that you are the Messiah, the Son of God, who is to come into the world. She had more faith than the disciples did in this moment, who were just coming with him to die. She believed that he was the life. Jesus says, if you believe in me, you will never die. Well, we've lived here long enough to know that bodies still decay and people still go into the grave. But if you're aware of what a lot of people believe, they believe that's the end. And Jesus is telling her, that's not the end. It's not just that someday your body will be resurrected. No, life starts now. I'm the resurrection and the life. And she affirms that and says, I believe that you are the Messiah, the Son of God, who has come into the world. And she doesn't waste any time. She goes back and she gets Mary and says, the Lord's here. Now, I find it interesting that she didn't repeat what she heard from Jesus. But I think she wanted Mary to hear it for herself. Because Mary's response in coming to Jesus is she says the exact same thing that Martha did. If you had been here, my brother wouldn't have died. But she doesn't have quite the same faith that Martha did. Because she doesn't follow it by, and I know you that God will give you whatever you ask even now. But Jesus' response isn't a theological discussion with her like he had with Martha. He's moved because he loves these people, because he's human. And even though he knows what's about to happen, he feels the pain of the loss. And we know that Jesus, being on earth, went through everything that we go through, including the loss of loved ones. And we suspect he's already lost Joseph, his adopted father. And I'm sure there's been other people he's loved and lost. But here he is losing a dear friend. And not only is he grieved, but as he's moved by her weeping, he says, where is he? Where have you put him to rest? Where have you laid him? And so they say, come and see. And then Jesus, he just can't take it anymore, and he breaks down. See, even Jesus knew that he had to grieve, he had to mourn, he had to express his feelings about what had happened. And it's more than just the fact that he lost his friend. I believe he's grieving, he's weeping, because death is still at work in the world. That what he's about to do in the coming weeks hasn't taken place yet. And death still has a hold on us. But the Jews' response is, oh, look, he loves him. Yeah, he did. He does. But I think Jesus was weeping even for the greater issue here of death still being allowed to have a place. But even the Jews doubt. But some of them said, could not he who opened the eyes of the blind man have kept this man from dying? And Jesus is moved again, and he comes to the tomb. And he says, take away the stone. Now, this tomb was a cave. And most tombs in Israel were caves. And what they do is they take the body, and they'd wrap it up in these linens, and they put all these spices on there so it wouldn't start stinking right away, because they hadn't discovered the art of keeping a body. And they would put this body in a stone tomb, and they'd lay it on the floor, they'd lay it up on a stone slab, and they'd literally just let it sit there and rot for a year. Talk about going to the gravesite of a loved one. I mean, that must have been something. But they'd let the body do that for a year, and then they would collect after everything had decomposed. You know, then they would go back in and they would take the bones and they'd put them in a little box and they'd put the box up on the shelf. And then the table's there ready for the next person. That's kind of morbid. I apologize. But that's the fact. Because when Jesus comes to the tomb and he says, open the door, and they roll the stone away, Martha's response is, don't do that. He stinks. You don't want to go in there. She's already forgotten what Jesus has just told her. She's already forgotten that she believes that God can do more. How often do we come to Jesus and forget, even after he's already healed us, or we've seen a loved one get well, or we've seen a miracle, or something he's done in our lives clearly, and yet moments later we forget who he is? And Jesus prays. And he says, Father, I thank you that you have heard me. I knew that you always hear me, but I say this for the benefit of the people standing here, that they may believe you sent me. Significant prayer. And then Jesus does something amazing. He doesn't go in. He says, Lazarus, come out. Now, I've heard a lot of commentators say, we're pretty sure he did this because if he had just said, come out, the whole graveyard would have risen. And that's kind of a funny thing to say, but I want you to think about the power of resurrection. Jesus isn't just raising one person. He's reaching into the future, past what he's about to do in a few weeks, when he dies and raises from the dead. And he brings something back from that place to Lazarus. Just like he did with the little girl previously. Because he hasn't yet done the work that needs to be done in order for the resurrection to take place. He hasn't conquered death yet. And yet he's reaching into the future and he's bringing the future into the present. And he's raising Lazarus from the dead simply by using his voice and speaking into existence what needs to be. And the dead man came out, his hands and feet wrapped with strips of linen and a cloth around his face. And Jesus says to them, take off your grave clothes and let him go. I think a lot of times... Yeah, we're doing for time. I think a lot of times when we come to Jesus and he brings us to life and he does, in a sense, for us spiritually what he did for Lazarus physically, we tend to walk around still with our grave clothes on. Now, I don't know if that's what John meant for us to understand from this passage, but John had a tendency to have a deeper meaning to everything he said. And I think it's possible that just like Lazarus came out of the grave in the flesh, and somehow all his 4 days of rotting and the death, the sickness that had killed him were gone, and he was back to being who he always was. Jesus, in giving us new life, wants to remove all the things that have to do with death. And he wants us to live. He wants to take away the fear. He wants to take away the bitterness, the rejection, the abandonment, the lies, the hate, the envy, the hateful words we speak to one another, and all the other things that have to do with death and sin. And in giving us new life, he wants to take off the grave clothes so that we can be free. Because if you've seen a mummy, you know they can't move really well wrapped in those. And if we're going to live the life that Jesus has for us, there's things, there's false beliefs, and there's ways of living life that have to go. And I was reminded of that this week as I was looking at a Facebook post yesterday. I don't know who Bill Malone is, but a friend of mine reposted his post. And I thought, this is an interesting post. I'm going to do some research and see if this is truth or if this is just Facebook. So I looked, and sure enough, this is true. I think one of the things that we need to change when it comes to death is we need to quit thinking the way the world does. And we have to realize what's in this post. One of the most common conflicts for American Christians as individuals and churches is the conflict of gospel issues versus social issues. I knew this conflict had a history going back to Billy Graham and the Civil Rights era, but in fact it goes back a lot further than that to slavery. In 1727, Edmund Gibson, the Bishop of London, wrote to slave owners in Virginia, acknowledging their worries that if they baptized their slaves, they would then have to set them free. Gibson wanted slave owners to baptize their slaves, so he told them that embracing the gospel does not make the least alteration in civil property or in any of the duties which belong to civil relations. Ironically, I think the slave owners understood Christianity better than a well-meaning bishop like Gibson. Deep down, they knew that Christianity challenged the entire institution of slavery. The slave owners preferred to sear their consciences and keep their money rather than follow the faith they claimed. But Gibson somehow could live with the idea that Christianity and chattel slavery could coexist because he had reduced Christianity to baptism. This is the historical root of the gospel issues versus social issues conflict in America. Well-meaning people throughout history who made half-hearted, respectable attempts at social progress rather than recognize the full humanity of downtrodden people, rather than sacrifice personal respectability for the sake of those people. Theoretically, they prioritized the good news, but they had actually reduced the Christian life to the task of growing and expanding Christianity, which unsurprisingly hindered the growth and expansion of Christianity because it tolerated evil. Separating the good from the news never ends well. Why did I have that up there? Because I think a lot of times we've limited Christianity to praying a prayer and coming to church. And maybe if it's a good day, I might remind my neighbors that I'm a Christian. But it doesn't go any further than that. Jesus put an end to death and evil, and everything that has to do with death. Everything that is corrupting us as people, he has already put an end to. Part of the reason we're still here on earth is because people need to know that. But that means we can't keep living as evil people and keep living with the grave clothes on and the things of this world wrapped us so tightly that we're too afraid to do the things that need to be done in order to show that the gospel not only has meaning, but it has substance. We have to be willing to stand up for our brothers and sisters who are suffering because of the color of their skin or because of their social status or because they can't get a job or because they're sick or because they were born deformed. And we have to start believing that the gospel has the power to resurrect dead things. Which means we have to have the faith, like Martha had, to say, even now, God, or Jesus, whatever you ask God, the Father will do. Are we going to be those people? Are we going to be people that believe? Or are we going to be like the Pharisees who, in a few verses later, said, oh, this is no good. This guy raised people from the dead. Rome's going to come down on us, and we're going to lose our cushy place in society. And we're going to lose our country. Or are we going to say, in a sense, what Thomas said, let's go die with him? Are we going to have the faith to believe that even now, what we ask the Father for, he desires to do? And if we're not getting answers to our prayers, it's more likely that our motives are wrong than that we're not asking what God wants to do in our lives and in the lives of others. We've got to remove the grave clothes. We've got to believe the words of this song. Whether now or then, death is not my end. I know heaven waits for me. Though the road seems long, I'll never walk alone, and I got all I need to sing. And while I'm waiting, I'm not waiting, because I know heaven lives in me. Do you believe that? Do you actually believe that the Son of God in his spirit is living inside of you? And that the power of the resurrection and the life that he has won for you is at work in you? How is that affecting the way you live your life day in and day out? How is it affecting the decisions you make and the things you say and the way you treat other people and the things that you fight for on behalf of others? Or are we just kind of still stuck in our sorrow and our disappointment and our uncertainty and our fear? And looking to that day, someday, I'm going to die and I'm going to be raised again. Or are you living like heaven is here now? And that the kingdom, as Jesus said, is ever expanding from this day forward. That the life everlasting is available in every area of our lives. It doesn't mean that we won't face death, that we won't need to mourn and weep. It doesn't mean we won't face disappointment. But it might need to dictate how we deal with it when we see it and we live through it. And that we put our faith, like Martha did in Jesus, and say, I believe. I believe. And I'm going to live like I believe. So what now? Roll the stone away. Call the dead things out. Call them back to life. Just like Jesus, our prayers, the words that come out of our mouth, are powerful. It's true, we've all lost loved ones. Remember, I told you about praying for resurrection for my dad and not seeing it come. And sometimes that's the case. But we still have to live like we believe. We still have to ask for it like we believe. We still have to believe that heaven is in here. And while I'm waiting, I'm not waiting because heaven lives in me. Roll the stone away. Oh, call dead things to life. Remove the obstacles. Remove the things that are keeping you from God. We're the ones in the grave. Jesus is calling us out. Are we going to take off the grave clothes? Are we going to take off the things that are of death? There's those things in our lives that need to go because they're not leading us to life. They're leading us away from it. Their attitudes, there's actions, there's beliefs. They got to go. I believe even now the Lord's speaking to you about what those things are. And they need to go. And then believe believe that Jesus is all he claims to be. And then we're not going to just say, someday we'll see the resurrection. But how is the resurrection working in my life today? How is he bringing life to me today? And do I have the faith, even when I see death all around me, to believe that he can still bring the dead back to life, both spiritually and physically? And will I take the risk to trust him in that and leave the mystery up to him as to what happens next?
Crosspoint Alliance Church is a Christ-centered Acts 1-8 family. Our hope is that you've heard from God today. You can be part of the Crosspoint family by praying for this ministry. You can write or send your donation to Crosspoint Alliance Church, P.O. Box 681552, Charlotte, North Carolina 28216. CLT.org. Thanks again for joining us. Come back next week for another edition of the Crosspoint.